When the latest news broke about the NSA's surveillance of Americans' communications, sales of George Orwell's 1984 went through the roof. In that classic, protagonist Winston Smith defies state control by having a love affair and, basically, thinking rebellious thoughts. What would defying state control look like in 2013? Writer and digital activist Cory Doctorow considered the question in his novel Little Brother.
They set up a little screen at the end of the truck, and they came for us, one at a time, unshackling us and leading us to the back of the truck. I was third, brought back by the woman with a severe haircut. They had a little table between them with the contents of my wallet and my backpack spread out on it. "Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "We have some questions for you." "Am I under arrest?" I asked. This wasn't an idle question. If you're not under arrest, there are limits on what the cops can and can't do to you. "What's this for?" she said, holding up my phone. "Am I under arrest?" I repeated. "You're being detained by the Department of Homeland Security," the woman snapped. "You think I'm a terrorist? I'm 17 years old." "Just the right age. Al-Qaeda loves recruiting impressionable young idealistic kids. Now, I want you to unlock this phone and decrypt the files in its memory. I want you to account for yourself. Why were you out on the street? What do you know about the attack on this city?" "I'm not going to unlock my phone for you," I said indignantly. "My phone's memory has all kinds of private stuff on it. Photos, emails, little hacks and mods I've installed. In hindsight, maybe I should have unlocked my phone for them."
Little Brother is a tale of techno-geek rebellion.
This is a book about some friends who are, you know, clever, techie, creative kids who are out in San Francisco one day skipping school and playing a kind of scavenger hunt called an alternate reality game where you go around and try and find clues. And someone blows up the Bay Bridge. And they can't really explain to the Department of Homeland Security, who picked them up as they swarm the city in the wake of this terrible disaster, they can't really explain to them what they're doing. Because first of all, you know, scavenger hunt's just kind of a weird excuse for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And second of all, they're under the mistaken apprehension that they've been arrested by the police. And they do what you should do if you're arrested by the police. They say, "Am I under arrest? If I am, give me a lawyer." And they just keep repeating that to the great anger of the authoritarians who've picked them up. To the point where they're not just released as harmless kids, but rather taken in and very intensively and abusively questioned. One of them isn't released at all. And when they get back onto the street again, they find San Francisco in a kind of police state lockdown. And based on that radicalizing experience, they decide that they're going to declare war on the Department of Homeland Security if that's what it takes to bring the Bill of Rights back to America.
Now, were there any particular events or, say, newspaper headlines or anything you read that inspired this book?
The thing that really got me going here, the two things that got me going anyway, the first one is that if you're a young person today, you may not have the experience that I did when I was, you know, 8 years old. My dad brought home a computer, which was the experience that I suddenly found in technology, a tool for empowering myself, getting more control over my life, all these great networks and tools and ideas. You might see computers and technology as tools for following you around and snitching on you and controlling you, because that's what young person's technology is often about today, you know, whether it's the spyware on a school network that's monitoring every click and sending it to some, you know, sleazy company that's supposed to be keeping kids safe from bad things, or mobile phones that let your parents follow you around town. So I really wanted to show kids that they could use technology to gain more freedom.
Mm. You know, the action in the book takes place in the not very far distant future. The high school students are being spied on by school authorities all the time in a way that you're suggesting really isn't all that different from today.
Sure. I mean, there's schools in Texas that are putting felon tracking anklets on kids who are truant. And actually, the life cycle of surveillance and control technology, it moves through populations that have less agency or less political juice and kind of is staged up to more and more general populations. So, you know, first we try out things like CCTVs or tracker bracelets on paroled felons and prisoners and mental patients. And then once we work some kinks out of them, you know, they're the first kind of, they're the alpha testers. We move to the beta testers, who are people like kids. And then we move to the general population. You know, we go in software terms, we ship the gold master. And the gold master is what we have now in London, for example, with surveillance technology, where we have cameras on every corner. Your Oyster card reads your every transit ride and can be linked back to you and can track your movements around town. Every license plate is photographed at almost every intersection. I think that kids really are the beta testers of the surveillance society. So it behooves us all to pay attention to what's going on with them and also to get them mobilized about it.
The important thing about security systems isn't how they work, it's how they fail. That was the first line of my first blog post on Open Revolt, my ex-net site. I was writing as M1K3Y, Mikey, and I was ready to go to war.
What do the kids in your book wind up doing about it? How do they resist or rebel?
Well, they build a lot of technology. In fact, it's not so much that they build technology as they repurpose technology in the grand tradition of the great hardware and software hackers who have taken as their motto, if you can't open it, you don't own it, that real Yankee ingenuity sensibility that says, you know, when you've got a computer, you need to get under the hood and figure out how to get it to dance to your will. And so they start by taking these Xboxes that everyone has lying around, and they figure out how to jailbreak these Xboxes so they can load their own operating system, their own software on it. And then they use that to build a cryptographically secured wireless network that spans San Francisco and that incorporates social media, games, and also message boards and organizational tools. And they use this to organize citywide civil disobedience, free concerts in the park, jamming surveillance technology. They build readers that can read people's contactless cards, like their contactless keys, their contactless ID, like the RFID chips that we see in passports and so on. So they build readers and writers, and they bump into people and they read all the numbers off of their cards, and they bump into someone else and they write the numbers to those cards so that everyone's identity gets mixed up and all the statistical stuff for figuring out who's being a naughty person gets totally confounded.
I was cautious and conservative compared to a lot of ex-netters. A couple of girls in the chemical engineering program at UC Berkeley, they figured out how to make a harmless substance out of kitchen products that would trip off explosive sniffers. They had a merry time sprinkling it on their profs' briefcases and jackets. Then, they'd hide out and watch the same profs try to get into the auditoriums and libraries on campus, only to get flying tackled by the new security squads that had sprung up everywhere. I passed by San Francisco General Hospital and nodded with satisfaction as I saw the huge lines at the front doors. They had a police checkpoint too, of course, and there were enough ex-netters working there that everyone's badges had been snarled up and swapped around. I read the security checks had tacked an hour onto everyone's workday, and the unions were threatening to walk out unless the hospitals did something about it. I headed home the long way, circling through the Mission to see the havoc. Long lines of cars, BART stations lined up around the blocks, people swearing at ATMs that wouldn't dispense their money because they had their accounts frozen for suspicious activity. I got home and made myself a sandwich and logged onto the XNet. It had been a good day. People from all over town were crowing about their successes. We had brought the city of San Francisco to a standstill. The news reports confirmed it. They were calling it the DHS gone haywire, blaming it all on the fake security that was supposed to be protecting us from terrorism. According to the Chronicle's economist, a week of this crap would cost the city more than the Bay Bridge bombing had.
Do you think of this as a subversive book?
Yeah, and I think technology is subversive in as much as technology generally gives the advantage to people who want to disrupt the status quo over people who want to defend it. Because defending something requires that you not have any vulnerabilities. And attacking something requires that you find a vulnerability. So I think that technology always subverts whatever the status quo is, for good and ill. Sometimes the status quo is that we have a lot of personal liberty, and then technology figures out how to subvert that, right? I mean, the Stasi, for all their invasive surveillance, these are the secret police in East Germany, were severely limited by technology. They just couldn't surveil as well as they wanted to. The NSA was able to totally disrupt that status quo when they went into AT&T's data centers, like the one on Folsom Street in San Francisco, and installed beam splitters on the fiber optic lines and illegally wiretapped an entire nation. So yeah, technology always subverts. Technology always disrupts.
I guess I'm curious about, you know, since your book has been out for a year now, have there been adults who've read the book who've been critical of it, who've said, you know, wait, you're giving kids entirely the wrong message. They're resisting the Department of Homeland Security, and you're teaching them to undermine school authorities, and we don't want our kids reading this book.
Well, don't I wish? I mean, wouldn't that be a lovely controversy to drum up readers? No, it turns out the only criticism that it's drawn from grown-ups, as near as I can work out, is that they don't like that about 3/4 of the way through the book, there's a scene in which two 17-year-olds who have a long-term committed relationship have safe sex. Not like graphic safe sex, like they decide to have sex, and then the chapter ends. And this has been like a source of enormous controversy among certain grown-ups. And to a lesser extent, I have been questioned by grown-ups about the fact that there's a scene where the kids drink beer. There's a scene where the kids talk about smoking marijuana and its derivatives. And there's a couple of scenes where they just sort of sass grown-ups generally. And it turns out that like sassing grown-ups, having a beer, or having safe sex at 17 is way, way, way more disruptive in adults' minds than like overthrowing the American government.
That's digital activist and writer Cory Doctorow talking about his novel, Little Brother. He talked with Anne Strange Chaps.